All right. So I am in studio here today with my friend Lee Neer, who came to chat with us about a really interesting project he gets to work on, one of the many amazing things you've done in your lifetime. Thanks for coming in, Lee.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. A little something different for me, that's for sure.
This is your first time at KMUD. I'm so glad you came.
Yeah, never stopped by here before.
I'm glad you made it.
Yeah. Well, I'm what is known as a GIS specialist, which is a geographic information systems specialist. And that's someone who does what most people recognize as spatial mapping, or I primarily do analysis of data and assembly of data. And I've had a career using the Esri GIS software, which I have my own ArcMap license that I've held for 20-some years. And, you know, when I started working with ArcGIS, Esri was 6 or 8 people.
Wow.
And now they're internationally with multiple branches all over the world. And they're probably it's a big statement, but every town or community almost in the world runs Esri software.
Wow.
When you go to their meetings in San Diego, it's really interesting to meet people from all over the world that pour into there. You know.
That's cool.
But one of the things I thought was funny is I started out running Esri GIS carrying boxes of key punch cards down to the mainframe computer at UC Riverside. And
wow.
You know, at least that was good enough to number them all, because every once in a while something had happened and you'd drop a box.
Oh,
and,
gosh.
You know, you'd have to – horrible back then, but anyway.
We've come so far.
Yeah.
Technology.
But really, I'm here to talk about the work I do primarily in the Altamont Pass Wind Resource Area. And that's located near where, if people know, US 580 goes from 5 inland through the Tracy area and past Livermore and on into the Bay Area. Well, the APRA, or the Altamont Pass Wind Resource Area, is in between Tracy and Livermore in there. And rough history-wise, the size of the APRA, or Altamont Wind Resource Area, is 68.5 square miles. It's fairly large.
Yeah.
And now we've started a new expanded study to relate the what happens in the Altamont region to the surrounding areas. And part of that is to guide possible acquisitions of more lands and things. But that area is 3,150 some square miles. It's
wow.
Way bigger.
Yeah, you've got your work cut out for you.
Yeah.
And when you're saying your the possible acquisition for more lands, this I hate to jump the gun, but you're saying that because you're talking about lands for wind turbines, right?
Correct.
Okay.
No. I'm talking about people want to,
like homes.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. The
stop speaking for you.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. No.
I'm talking about like the East Bay Regional Park District is trying to maybe acquire some properties.
Okay.
And there's several others, and I apologize, I don't have a list of all of those names.
That's okay.
That try to acquire highly desirable lands to preserve them for, like, the Golden Eagles or other natural uses.
Awesome.
And so our research tends to help guide them is where the lands that the Golden Eagles really like to utilize, so they can focus their efforts on attempting to get that. And sometimes they just get like easement type of things with, say, a rancher who grazes cattle out there, and
sure,
he'll give them, you know, like a written guarantee, you know, that. That land will be preserved, you know.
But, awesome.
But in the Altamont, because it's a high wind area, I mean, it's very rare to have still days there. But back in the 90s, there was maybe 8,000 some turbines left there,
wow.
At least over 7,000. And they were all shorter. Their tower height was maybe 14 to 43 meters.
Okay.
And they were kind of just throwing out there in big long lines. You could see them all over all the ridges. And there were hundreds of golden eagles dying every year being killed by those.
Oh, my gosh.
And by around 2005, the numbers had drawn down to 5,000 because they were wearing out and falling down and they weren't being replaced. And they were replacing them with some slightly larger ones that had a tower height of maybe 45 to 60 meters. And currently, almost all those old turbines have been removed. And we're left with about 200-some newer-style turbines. And they are, say, the towers are maybe 80 meters high. And we have a new one that's just was put in that the tower is 110 meters.
Wow.
And they have like 2 to 3 blades, and those blades are like 97 or 100 feet long.
Oh, my gosh.
And they turn, and people look at them and they go, oh, they're going slow. But when you think of a 100-foot radius that's going around, that tip is moving at a big rate. And the big problem associated with the turbines is that golden eagles are being hit and often killed by the rotating blades. And it's there's several documented incidents where the eagles have died from colliding with turbine towers that don't even have blades on them.
Oh, my gosh.
They're being, like, shut down or just being built. And, it, you know, I am no expert in that. I mean, I'm a numbers guy. I do the number processing. But there's some thought that they're just not expecting to see something like that in their DNA, if you will.
Sure, yeah.
And they just fly over and what's this banging into the thing and they end up getting killed.
Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I've been thinking about this for days now since we said we're going to talk about this. And I'm wondering, is it partially because the towers are white? So they like kind of blend in with the sky? Like what if they were like neon pink? Would they be better for the birds?
They've tried all kinds of things, painting stripes all over them, painting them different colors, and none of that seems to work, you know.
Yeah.
But I primarily do the golden eagle studies with Sean Smallwood, who's a PhD out of UC Davis, and Doug Bell, who's a PhD. He's actually a graduate of Cal Poly Humboldt.
Hey.
Yeah. And he works for the East Bay. He's a program manager for the East Bay Regional Park District.
Cool.
And he started a lot of this. So I model the terrain and winds, all kinds of things, the slope, aspect, elevations, and then I model the golden eagle behavior from the points that are collected. And so Doug Bell has, starting in about December of 2012, started, they very carefully capture golden eagles and equip them with these small little, I call them backpacks that are like little cigarette packs.
Okay.
And they have a GPS in them. They have a solar cell that powers them, a very small computer. And they also have the ability to transmit via the global system for mobile communication type transmitters. They transmit every couple of days where they've been, like either every 15 minutes, but more often every 30 seconds, sometimes every 1 second. And so this turns into a lot of data.
Yeah.
And we've had, over the years since 2012, we've had 43 of these golden eagles equipped. And some of them don't last very long at all. They get hit by a turbine. And others last quite a long time and travel all over.
So when, I don't know if you know this either, but I apologize. When you find out that a bird has hit a turbine and it died, who does that information go to and what is done about it?
Well, there are people who are supposed to inspect the region, the big polygon areas underneath turbines.
Yeah.
To see if anything has been killed there.
Uh-huh.
You know, but let me first run through.
Sure, go ahead.
I just want to say, I have 15 scripts I have to run against the raw data to convert it into what I'm usable stuff. and a bunch of raw GIS procedures that I do on the data. But primarily I download all the raw data from Cellular Tracking Technologies company, and I fill out all the attributes. And I also look at when the bird is flying along, the degree of turn it makes. So I can tell when a bird is making really sharp turns or series of sharp turns. And like I mentioned to you when we were talking about that, I also attribute the points and the lines that I create between the points. I intersect them with the land use data set that I have and a couple other agencies' polygons. And so I can attribute those, and it's very interesting that golden eagles do not like to fly over developed areas. And so you'll see they're going, and they go over like a housing subdivision area, and they go into it. They don't get very far. They make sharp turns and head out.
Yeah.
And the only other time they make those kind of sharp turns normally is when they're flying at a higher altitude, and either they're taking advantage of some updrafts or winds, or for some reason they want to, like, dive or look at something, but it's very brief, and then they continue on.
Gotcha.
They're traveling, you know. And after I do all that, Sean then performs a series of statistical analyses on the cleaned-up data, and we have a bunch of peer-reviewed publications that have been created. But
awesome.
When you look at it, to date, I have processed about 5,490,000 points.
Whoa.
From these 43 birds. You know, this stuff takes a lot of time and computer resources.
Yeah.
And I have to write all the steps and what step I'm on, because, you know, if something takes 15 minutes or 20 minutes to run, well, I want to go out and do something else.
Yeah.
Then you come back in, it's so easy to forget which of the, you know, myriad of steps they go through, where exactly you are.
Yeah.
So I have to be very careful like that. But the eagles mostly stay in the coastal hill range, like I was showing you. They fly up and down the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple have traveled all the way to Oregon and back. And several have traveled to a lot of the mountainous areas, kind of near the inland Santa Barbara area, north of L.A., and one traveled on across Riverside County and then back around up and north to the Southern Sierras and almost made it to Las Vegas. And I know, well, this bird wants to get it on, you know, with the Vegas. But another one similar to that followed that same path and then veered off after went across Riverside County and continued east, just west of Yuma, and then went down into Mexico. And this bird went all over, like I was showing you on the map, Mexico, and basically stopped transmitting in Mexico south of the Big Bend National Park area in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, wow. I mean, that's a lot of traveling. But,
yeah. And so Lee showed me earlier on a map that he's got these lines literally showcasing everywhere these golden eagles have been, and they seem to follow similar flight patterns in general. They kind of go in the same places, and maybe that's because of wind current, or is that like where the best
wind currents, and those are the hills, and you know they like that mountainy, hilly area.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of they like to swoop over ridges or saddles and defeat and attack.
Sure.
But, you know, two of the repowering projects, the Vasco Wind and Summit Winds projects within the APRA or Altamont, follow the sighting recommendations that our research produced, and they have performed very well and kill almost no eagles.
Wonderful.
There are other cases with other companies where that hasn't been the case, and there are like a single turbine that was placed in a saddle or a bad spot, and they consistently kill a golden eagle there. But one of the things that even the turbines that maybe aren't killing golden eagles right now, they're still killing small birds and a lot of bats. And, you know, people go, whoa. But bats are very important in an ecological sense,
yeah.
You know, maybe even more than golden eagles. I mean, they have a real significant role in the ecology. And they, like, at nighttime surveys with infrared cameras and looking at them, they like to chase the turbine blades,
no.
You know, like playing with them.
Funny.
But, you know, they can get distracted and forget about it, and boom, they get whacked. And we were searching for them, and or I wasn't, excuse me. There were people looking for bats, and they weren't finding any. And they're saying, Sean, you're wrong. You know, there aren't a lot of bats being killed. And Sean's going, well, I'm looking at night, and I'm seeing bats getting killed or hit.
Yeah.
And so they went out in one study area and defined these polygons around the turbine base, and they hunted for bats. And they found one bat in this big area. And these are big polygons, like 300 feet in radius around
a pretty big
several
area.
Turbines. They found one bat and all that.
Yeah.
Then they took a team of dogs out there.
Yeah.
So the people had dogs with them, and they found 71 bats in that same area.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's the difference. You know, dogs really are the solution there.
There you
know?
Go.
And one thing I was going to mention, that ocean-located turbines seem almost impossible to quantify bird death for collision.
Yeah, because it'll just fall in the water, right?
Fairly lead researcher back more on the East Coast was looking for them, but he only really was looking on the beach for washed-up birds. And certainly, you know, from marine mammal monitoring effort that I do, you know,
yeah.
you
Which
find dead birds on the beach all the time.
And, all the time, yeah. They could be from anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And most of the birds probably don't make it to shore. When they hit a turbine, they probably sink, or maybe
right.
a shark ate it.
Or something eats them. You know. And there have been ways to try to find, even on land, to mitigate eagle deaths by trying to stop the turbine when a flying bird is detected coming at it.
Yeah, it's a good start.
The very hard thing to understand about that really is that you got a 97-foot long blades on top of these turbines. They don't just turn the switch and stop them.
Yeah.
It takes anywhere from 1 to 3 minutes to get that blade stopped. And the eagles have been timed at taking from the detection distance about 15 seconds to traverse that distance.
Goodness.
So there's a real problem there. And plus, that these devices that try to stop the turbines are extremely hard on the bearings of the turbines, and you know would be expected to perhaps wear them out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Way earlier,
you know. Yeah, like driving Shelter Cove Road is going to wear out your brakes faster.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, we all buy them every couple of months. But but it's been a very interesting number of years doing this work. And
And it really sounds like your research is paying off, because you can see that when the turbines aren't placed in the places that you've said they really fly here a lot, that the deaths have been much fewer. So I wish there was a way to force all those wind turbine groups to just put them where it's safe for eagles. And is that on the horizon? Is it like, are golden eagles an endangered species that we can push something like that?
Well, I don't think they're classified as an endangered species.
I don't think so either.
But the idea is trying to get the companies to buy into making what really is a relatively small effort to relocate and not every one of their turbines, just the ones that they were going to put in turbine locations that are seen as being very having great potential for eagle deaths.
Right, yeah. In like the saddles, like you said, or like directly over the top of a hill when they can't really see it coming, and then they get to the top and there it is.
Especially the multiple cases where they've actually run into towers with no blades on them.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, so it's the location that's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not even the fact that there's a turbine with blades. It's the tower being placed there.
That's where, you know? That's like their road. Yeah, like, don't put a turbine in the middle of the road.
Right, right.
This is just a random thought out of nowhere. I was like, what if they used echolocation to scare off the bats and like told the bats like, hey, we're here.
There have been any number of attempts to do that for both birds and bats.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the bats just do their thing.
Yeah. I'm going to have a show someday just about bats. In fact, there's a gentleman I'm trying to get a hold of, and it's very hard to reach him. He's pretty elderly, and he doesn't use the internet. So I'm trying to meet with a man who sells bat houses in Lake County, and he calls himself Batman. So I really want to meet the Batman. If he can hear me, call me.
Well, one of my good friends owns a home way up on the ridgeline over Lake Mendocino. And when he bought that home up there, he asked the gal who was selling it, you know, what is the smell over here on the side of the garage? And she goes, oh, that's my bat house.
Oh,
and he goes, you know, to himself and to his wife, he goes, well, we're going to have to get rid of that thing. You
that's
know?
Hilarious.
But then they were sitting around their house after they moved in, and they would watch. And it's to me, it's unbelievable the number of bats that come out of this little thing that's like 2.5 feet wide and 3 or 4 feet high.
And they're protecting
and
their own home
from mosquitoes.
It
looks like
mosquitoes.
6 inches deep. And bats come out of there for like 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, it's crazy. So
but
you actually,
they're watching them, and they're going, you know, I like having these bats here. Yeah. And they ended up putting up another house, and over in a tree, they put another one over on the other side of their property.
Bat houses are awesome. I highly recommend. Yeah. If you haven't checked that out, we have a couple on our house, and we put them on our house to try to divert the bats from being inside the house. But anyway, to get back to the golden eagles, you said something about a friend of yours had a golden eagle pair living on their property, right? Wasn't that about Lake County area too?
Yeah, that's the same person with the bats.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he gets to watch the golden eagle pairs because golden eagles mate for life, and they come back to the same location every year to nest. But you were saying he noticed that they actually don't nest in the same nest every year.
Right. They have 3 or 4 nests that they alternate between, and they're fairly a tenth of a mile apart. I mean, they're not right next to each other by any means. But it's really almost comedic that the female just gets on the male, and he's physically a little smaller than her, actually. And she's just crabbing it up, basically telling him, get out and get something. I'm hungry.
Yeah, go get dinner already.
The dynamics going on there is really funny.
Oh, yeah, watching wildlife, man, one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
What a cool experience that you get to get information about where golden eagles are flying and map it and help save these eagles from what we're considering a positive thing. Wind power is green energy, you know. We call it like it's going to save the future, you know. So I love that you're helping make sure that it's going right. So thank you for that hard work, because I can hear you talking about how it's strenuous work that you're doing. It's very involved.
Well, not physically strenuous. I
mentally.
I spend tons of time on a laptop.
Yeah.
But the one good thing about that is that I've done work on cruise ships in the Caribbean and going up the Amazon River.
Oh, man.
You know, you can do it anywhere. You can get an internet connection to move data back and forth with, you know.
There you go. So GIS mapping, there's a lot of future in that, a lot of fun to be had.
It's, you know, GIS has really developed from, like I said, from the early days when there was just, 6 or 8 people at Esri, and you'd go over and talk to them and,
You knew them all by first name. Now you'll never know them all. That's so cool.
You know, Jack Dangerman, anyway, I won't get into all that.
Lee, thank you so much for coming in. And thank you. You know, I met you because you volunteer with Friends of the Lost Coast to do trail maintenance, and you also volunteer with MERP, the Marine Mammal Education, I think, Resource Program. I think that's what it's called. Again, thank you for committing to your community, because you don't just live here. You take part in keeping it safe and healthy. So I really appreciate you. You're a real go-getter, and you're always doing something new. It's really exciting.
Keeps me busy and
it's
keeps
awesome.
Me walking and moving. You know, I don't want to be on a stair-step machine. I'd rather get out and walk in nature.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, happy Earth Day. I'm so pleased that you were able to come in today.
All right.
And maybe another time. I know you said you don't love the idea, but maybe sometime we can talk about scuba, because I know you've got a lot to say about scuba diving as well.
Yeah, I learned scuba from one of the first people the Navy assigned to go during the end of World War II to go to France and meet with Jacques Cousteau and learn about this new thing.
know? Absolutely amazing.
Oh, crazy. So yeah,
so it was cool. You've seen more of the world above and below the sea than most people ever will. So
spent a lot of time in scuba diving, yeah, around San Clemente and Catalina Island and
wow,
up and down the coast. Yeah.
Wow. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in. And don't be a stranger.
Right.
Kmud is a community hub. You're always welcome to come say hi, and glad you came in today.
All right.
Thank you so much, Lee.
Bye.